The Parkland school shooter pleads guilty. Now comes the punishment and possibility of the death penalty. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. In court this week, Nicholas Cruz addressed the families of those he admitted to murdering and hurting. But his fate still will be up to a Broward County jury. He could be sentenced to death. We'll talk about what's next in the case for the victims' families and for the community. Plus, election time is here. One is a special race to succeed longtime Congressman Alcee Hastings. He died in April. There are a number of other local elections for mayor in Miami, Miami Beach, and Hialeah. And how late should last call be in Miami Beach? How has voting changed during this election? It's all ahead on the Roundup, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week and for supporting public radio. Confessed Parkland school shooter Nicholas Cruz pleaded guilty this week. He admitted to 17 counts of murder and 17 counts of attempted murder. This came less than a week after his defense attorneys told the judge he would change his plea. During the hearing on Wednesday, the shooter gave a rambling statement lasting less than a minute. He said he was very sorry for what he did. He also said he hated drugs and cannot watch television. It was an emotional day in court, certainly, coming 3.5 years after the school shooting. Tom Hoyer and his wife Gina lost their son, Luke.
When he said he wanted to speak, that was really an ugly surprise for us. Because there's nothing he can say that's going to change anything that he did.
His guilty plea means prosecutors do not have to convince a jury that he committed the crimes. However, his fate still will be up to a Broward County jury. He could be sentenced to death. He will at least spend his life in jail. So what's next for this case? What's next for the victims' families? What's next for the South Florida community? 800-743-9576 to join our conversation live on this Friday here on the South Florida Roundup. 800-743-WLRN on the telephone. You can also share your thoughts at WLRN is our handle on Twitter. Rafael Almeida is with us, Broward County criminal and civil courts reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. What's the next legal step in this case, Rafael?
Well, the first thing we're going to see is on Tuesday, we will have the parties returning to the courtroom, and they are going to start going over all of the legal motions to determine which ones are no longer necessary, because we're no longer going to have this first phase of his criminal trial. There are still plenty of motions and plenty of legal debates to have over what gets presented to the jury in the second phase. Mm-hmm. And so we'll still be having a lot of courtroom maneuvers taking place as far as that goes.
You mentioned the jury in the second phase. As I said, right, there was no need for a jury to decide guilty or not guilty, but there is still a significant role that a jury is going to play, given that prosecutors are still pursuing the death sentence here. So what's the timeline for the jury selection process?
You know, it could almost be argued that what Nicholas Cruz did on Wednesday was really just skip the formalities and let's get on to the part of this case where we don't know the outcome. Mm-hmm. And that is, of course, what happens. Does he live in the rest of his natural life in prison, or does he live the rest of his cut short life in prison? Mm-hmm. Either way, he's living his life in prison. In January, we are going to begin jury selection, according to the judge. And that is going to look very much like the last jury selection played out, which is first, the judge is going to bring all sorts of jurors into the room just to decide if they know the case and can be fair. What we found out the last time around was that there were a lot of people who just couldn't. In fact, some of them walked into the courtroom, took one look at Nicholas Cruz and just burst into tears.
Yeah.
which is significant because, you know, the last time the jury faced him, it was a case that had nothing to do with the murder.
Right.
It didn't matter.
Right, right.
It didn't matter.
Rafael, stick with us. Rafael Almeida is with us, Broward County Criminal and Civil Courts reporter for the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. Stephen Harper is with us. Stephen is emeritus professor at Florida International University Law School, longtime attorney here in South Florida. Stephen, welcome to the program. Thanks for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you.
So what is when the jury gets seated in this punishment phase, what is in front of it? What does the jury have to decide?
The jury has to basically weigh what they call the aggravators, and the aggravators are what the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. For example, the number of people killed is an aggravator. Cold, calculated, and premeditated is an aggravator. Prior violent offense is an aggravator. So the prosecutor will present all of the statutory aggravators, and then the defense will present mitigating factors. Some of the mitigating factors here, he acknowledged his guilt. He's only 18 at the time of the crime. He was adopted, and both of his adopted parents died about 3 months before this incident. He had a very unstable home. He was previously diagnosed as depression and autism and ADHD. So those are all the sort of, I haven't stated them all, but those are some of the mitigating factors. And then the jury will have to consider whether the aggravators outweigh the mitigators.
And describe that balance that a juror is going to be presented with and what the judge's instructions will be. Incredibly important here, as I'm sure you're very familiar with, Stephen, about how a juror, a layperson, takes a look at these aggravators or mitigating circumstances and decides which one takes priority.
Well, it's an interesting question. In the penalty phase, each juror individually decides whether the aggravators outweigh the mitigators or whether the mitigators outweigh the aggravators. So it is a personal decision for each juror. And interestingly enough, the jury is instructed to weigh the aggravators with the mitigators, but any juror can always vote for life. Even if the aggravators outweigh the mitigators, one juror, two jurors, whatever, can still vote for life.
And that one, it needs to be a unanimous verdict for a capital sentence to be carried out here in the state of Florida, which is a relatively new, within the past several years, change about how the capital punishment is executed for jurors.
That's correct. And so every juror has to be believe or rule that a death sentence is appropriate. If one juror, like you say, disagrees, then it's automatically life. The judge can't change that kind of verdict.
Yeah. Stephen Harper is with us, emeritus professor, Florida International University Law School. Rafael Almeida is the Sun Sentinel reporter covering Broward criminal and civil courts. We're talking about the confessed Parkland shooter pleading guilty this week to 17 counts of murder, 17 counts of attempted murder in the school shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in February 2018. 800-743-WLRN is our telephone number if you want to join our conversation. 800-743-9576. The punishment phase will get underway with jury selection in the coming months, and that jury will be presented with evidence and a defense as well, in the effort to, in terms of the defense, at least, to spare the shooter's life. Rafael, did prosecutors give a preview of the type of case that they're going to present in this punishment phase during the hearing this week in which the shooter pled guilty?
In fact, they did. Former state attorney Mike Satz, who has remained at work just to handle this case, gave an outline of the crime itself. He almost literally walked the judge and the audience, which was, you know, the media and the families, through step by step, through every bullet, every victim, everything that the defendant did that afternoon. He talked about how many shots were fired into this victim and whether that victim survived or not. He walked us through the first floor terror. He walked us through the second floor. He walked us through the third. He walked us along with the defendant into the teacher's lounge, into the effort to assume a sniper position from inside the building. He walked us through the failure of that effort. So it was not necessarily expected. It is a routine thing. It's often waived when a defendant pleads guilty. But in this particular case, I think it was necessary because we are going to have that penalty phase. Yeah. And we do need people to realize, you know, this wasn't pleading guilty to a parking ticket. This was a very, very serious offense and with a very serious emotional impact on the community.
Incredibly long-lasting emotional impact, which will continue, of course, even through the punishment phase and the public presentation of the evidence as well as the defense. Let's take a phone call here. Richard is listening and calling from Hollywood. Richard, thanks for tuning in to WLRN, and you are on the radio.
How you doing, sir?
Good.
I was just calling in today because I was reading at one point, and I believe that I read that Nicholas Cruz is on the autism spectrum. He obviously is high functioning, but as someone who has an autistic person in their family, you know, when you say someone who's high functioning, usually you mean that you're experiencing their symptoms mildly. It doesn't mean that what they're going through is any less severe. And I just want people to discuss, you know, the idea of applying a capital punishment to someone who is a mental health condition. And, you know, I feel like that hasn't been discussed enough in this situation. I feel like most of the public's not even aware of that fact.
Richard, thanks for bringing this up here. I appreciate that. Go ahead. Is that Steven?
I would say that's a very good point. One of the things that defense is going to have to do, and they will probably do this through experts, is talk about the effects on an 18-year-old of depression, ADHD, which is deficit disorders, and as the caller points out, autism. Autism is a very specific mental illness on a continuum. Some people it's mild, some people it's severe, but it affects social skills, it affects speech, and obviously people with autism oftentimes repeat behaviors. And that is a form, I think the defense will bring that out significantly.
Stephen, in your experience, as you worked at the Miami-Dade Public Defender's Office, how does a jury hear those types of, I guess in a punishment phase, those would be considered mitigating factors, no?
Yeah. Well, the jury would hear it probably through, there would be lay testimony as to his behavior, which would indicate he suffers from autism. And then there would be an expert or two experts that would talk, who are experts on autism, and they would tell the jury all the effects of autism on somebody like him and how that affected his thinking, how that affected his behavior. And that would hopefully, from the defense point of view, that would mitigate the seriousness of this crime, which is no question, this is a very, very serious crime.
As we walk through this, Stephen, first it would have to be established that the individual has this condition, correct?
Well, yes, but right. The defense can put that forward. And if there's enough evidence that he does, that would have to be accepted. And then the jury would have to weigh whether that, how much weight to give that autism. Is it a little or is it a lot?
Raphael, as we work through this process in this punishment phase, have prosecutors talked beyond the evidence? Have they talked at all about the role of victims in this punishment phase?
I just wanted to take a step backward for just a moment before I answer that question. I think you hit it when you said we need to establish, in fact, that Nicholas Cruz does have autism or suffers from autism. I have not heard a lot about that from the defense. We've talked about mental health. We've talked about him being troubled and disturbed, but I have not heard a lot about autism itself. And I think that was a suspicion early on when we were first learning about this defendant. But I don't know that that's ever been firmly established. So please be careful as we're talking about people on the autism spectrum, including my own son. You know, we're making sure that if that is in fact the case, then yes, it is going to be something that needs to be considered. But we have not established that it is the case.
Yeah, very important point, Raphael, and I'm glad that you took a step back to mention that, and to the professor's point as well. In what happens inside those four walls in this punishment phase, that's what the jury needs to consider, right? What's established during this process. It is not, frankly, what we talk about here on the South Florida Roundup, or Raphael, what you're reporting, or Professor, your analysis, with all due respect, right? It is what the jury hears, what the judge allows, and what is established in those four walls. Everything else, is talk.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let me apologize because I lost track of your initial question.
Not a problem. No, you made a very important point. I'm glad that we did it. What I was asking about was if we have heard anything at all from prosecutors regarding the role of victims' families in this punishment phase.
The families of the victims have the right to be to address the court during this penalty phase. They do not dictate what happens. They can't short circuit the death penalty by saying they oppose it. They can't insist on the death penalty and expect that to rule. It is the jury's call.
Yeah.
But the victims' families absolutely do have the right to present their thoughts. What's not as clear is the victims who are the attempted murder victims. I don't know that they get to say anything to the jury. They get to say something to the judge, but I don't know that they get to say anything to the jury about their feelings on what should happen. It's the death penalty cases are the murders. The attempted murders are not.
Right.
And those who were not wounded at all, not pierced by a bullet at all, have no say. They have to step over the bodies of their friends and their teachers, and they get nothing.
Yeah,
as far as that goes.
Stephen, to Raphael's important clarification there on the 17 murder charges, does that mean that prosecutors essentially have 17 chances to make a case for capital punishment?
Yes, they do. And just to let you know, if he puts forward evidence of autism, then a juror considers it, whether it's relevant, mm-hmm. how autistic he is, and how much that affects their idea as to what to do, whether they should find it as an aggravator or mitigator, whatever. So it doesn't take a lot of evidence to show that he is autistic. I don't know enough about the case to know whether he's put forward any argument as to autism, but my understanding is there is evidence that he is, and that would probably be something a juror could consider if he puts it into evidence.
Juror psychology, jury construction is been studied for a good number of years, Professor, and I'd like to just get your thoughts here. We're going to be talking about this case, obviously, in an ongoing. We'll be covering it here. But talk about the threshold that jurors are going to be faced with in weighing the evidence and then making this ultimate decision. And that threshold here, beyond a reasonable doubt. I will share with you, having served on a jury myself in a criminal case, and having faced and understood and listened to a judge's instructions about what reasonable doubt is, one of the things, honestly, that I walked away with was that it's popularly misunderstood oftentimes, in my estimation.
A couple of things. Yes, beyond a reasonable doubt is very misunderstood by a lot of people. I will tell you that as a trial lawyer, I found a lot of people didn't understand it. Some people did, but beyond a reasonable doubt, there's jury instructions on it. However, in the penalty phase, which is coming up, the prosecutor has to prove each of the aggravators beyond a reasonable doubt, but the defendant does not have to prove the mitigators beyond a reasonable doubt.
What's the threshold for those?
It's a different standard for the mitigators.
And what's that standard?
The standard is there a jury finds sufficient evidence to agree that it is relevant to their decision making, and even, again, it's individual jurors.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very low threshold, So again, that goes back to sort of the autism question. If there's evidence of his autism, a juror can consider it. Now, obviously jurors can say, I don't believe that he's autistic. One juror could say that. Another juror could say he is. So there's a very low threshold as to what is admissible on the defense side.
And then the question, of course, is what weight does an individual juror Correct. Give yes. any of those factors?
Right. One juror could decide that because of his age, 18, he should not receive the death penalty, period. Another juror could say, no, it's illegally okay to execute an 18-year-old. I'm not going to give any weight to his age.
And even jury selection, some of these questions are going to be posed to potential jurors, presumably.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the expertise and sharing the walk through some of the legal questions and terms. Stephen Harper, Emeritus Professor at Florida International University Law School, and Rafael Almeida will be watching his and listening and reading his reporting. He's the Broward County Criminal and Civil Courts reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. To both of you, thank you for spending your time here today on the South Florida Roundup.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come on our program, election time. It is here, a special race for a House seat in South Florida and local elections. We'll talk about it with you next. Stick around. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. Election time is here for a number of voters across the region. Yeah, there's several local elections and ballots, including mayors in Miami, Miami Beach, and Hialeah. Voters are asked a question about how late last call should be on South Beach, for instance. And then there's the race to succeed a long-serving congressman who passed away this past spring. This is the race, the primary race, in the 20th Congressional District, which borders Broward and Palm Beach County. So let's talk about some local elections. Line up your phone calls now. What races are you watching? Questions you're curious about? How are you voting? Questions about the process to vote in this election. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. But first, the congressional race in the 20th Congressional District, the congressional primary. We spoke with Palm Beach Post Politics and Growth editor Antonio Finns earlier today. Antonio, welcome back to the South Florida Roundup. This is an incredibly crowded ballot for Democrats in this congressional district, this special election. Describe the roster for Democratic voters.
It's about 12 different candidates, and you've got a bunch of state representatives, Broward County commissioners, state senator. It is one of the most diverse fields of candidates that I have seen in many, many years down here. And it's a really important choice that the voters have to make both in Broward and Palm Beach. And let's not forget that this is one of those really weirdly drawn districts yep. that kind of meanders around these two counties. So there aren't many municipalities in those two counties that don't have some bit of this. And I think that's a concern here.
How
so? To make sure that everybody who's in that district knows they're in that district and knows this race is happening. Because the choice that is made here is going to be incredibly important. Remember, this is a U.S. House of Representatives seat. It is a safe Democratic district. You know, you do have two Republican candidates. There will be a general election in early January. But this has been a seat that has been in the Democrats' hands for many decades. And in fact, Alcee Hastings was there for 30 years before he passed away this year. But here's the thing, that in the House of Representatives, the Democrats are in control. But they have a really slim majority, and their own that majority is kind of divided between these more centrist moderate Democrats and these progressives that are far more to the left. So the question is, who will win this seat here? Will it be another more moderate centrist vote, or will it be a more progressive liberal vote?
We're seeing that play out during the infrastructure negotiations between the White House and kind of both sides of the Democratic Party, in addition to, of course, Republican senators and House members on Capitol Hill. As it relates to this particular special election, this primary coming up on the Democratic side, you've mentioned this has been a safe Democratic seat in the U.S. House for more than a generation. Is it garnering much attention from national Democrats as they understand this is a bit of a turf battle between the progressive wing and the more moderate wing of the Democratic Party?
Yes, it is. But I think that they're trying to keep a hands-off approach. You don't see leading progressives in Capitol Hill or even some of the centrist Democrats coming down here to stump for particular candidates. They're kind of keeping their hands off. And it's because you have such a wide array of candidates. Right. I mean, let's just take two of the more high profile ones, you know, in Broward County, County Commissioner Barbara Sharif, who's more of a moderate centrist. Then you've got in Palm Beach County, Omari Hardy, a state representative who's this firebrand, who has really kind of made a name for himself in Tallahassee by being somebody like the bull in the china shop, so to speak, mm-hmm. somebody who's a real diehard and is outspoken and a clear voice for progressive values. And across the board, there are others. You know, you have Perry Thurston and Sheila McCormick. I mean, there are a lot of candidates in this race in both sides of that internal Democratic debate. But I think right now on Capitol Hill, everybody's just sort of like, you know, sitting back and letting this play out. But yeah. You got to believe they're looking at this.
Given this crowded field, upwards of 11 candidates for Democrats to choose from in this upcoming special election, name recognition is going to play a large part. You've got five currently elected officials and a sixth former Palm Beach County commissioner who are on the ballot. So there's some name recognition there. What about the fundraising? Has that been able to separate some candidates from the pack?
Well, I think if you look at the advertising, you look at the emphasis, yeah, it has. I mean, you know, Sharif clearly has a base. But at the end of the day, I don't think it's going to be about that. I think it's going to be about getting your block of voters out there. And in that case, those who are elected officials, well, you know, they've run campaigns before. They've run get out the vote efforts before. And that's going to be critical. That's what's going to decide this race. I mean, the problem with this district, like as we mentioned earlier, is that it does meander through so much of these two counties.
Yeah.
If you're going to mount a two-county strong campaign, you're going to need a lot of money because it's two different media markets.
So right.
The Palm Beach County media market and the Broward County, it's completely different TV stations and radio stations, you know. So I think this is going to be a get out the vote effort. And that's why, as I said earlier, you want to make sure that any of your voters who are in this district know that they're in this district and go vote.
Given that this seat and this district had been represented by Representative Hastings for 30-some years, how do voters lean? Are they leaning more moderate, historically speaking? Has there been more of a progressive slant toward the voters through the years?
Well, no, this has been, you know, Alcee Hastings was one of the more moderate centrists. Mm-hmm. I mean, but if you look at the map, there are places in this district that are progressive, you know, hotbeds. And it's really been in the last 4, 5, 6 years that the progressive movement within the Democratic Party has really been surging forward. So I don't think we can say, okay, you know what, this district has been in, you know, Hastings had it for 30 years. He's more of a moderate. It's a moderate district. I don't think we can take that for granted.
With Florida's resigned to run law, what are the stakes for Democrats, given that you've got five currently elected Democrats on the ballot?
Yeah, I mean, they're I guess you could say their political futures are on the line. You know, although some of these candidates have run for office before, they've held office. And I think that, there's a future for them, regardless how this turns out.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think we should also note that This does kind of mark a change in South Florida's sort of congressional history here. I mean, it was not unheard of for somebody like a Dante Fasel, a Claude Pepper, you know, Ileana Ross Leighton, to be in office as a member of Congress for decades.
Right.
We're not seeing that anymore. I mean, across Florida, in the 2020 elections, you had a bunch of Republican members who are two or three at least that had served maybe 5, 6 years and decided to leave office. And then you have the District 26, I think, down in Miami,
yep.
where in the last decade, five different people
yeah.
have held that position. So the idea that whoever wins the special election has got to run again in next year
right.
to keep the seat.
Right.
So whoever wins this race in January may end up stay campaigning because I don't think you can, there aren't a lot of seats in Congress these days. Well, there are down here that are pretty safe. Okay, this guy, you know, Mario Diaz-Balart, for example, he's going to keep that seat probably as long as he wants it. But some of these other seats are very competitive. The ones where Maria Elvira Salazar is in.
The 27th congressional
one. Yeah, 27th. Yeah. That's another one that, hey, you know, that's changed hands a couple of times here. So I think this is going to be very competitive. And whoever loses this time, if they run a strong race, you may see them on the ballot again this time next year.
Antonio Fins is the politics and growth editor at the Palm Beach Post. Antonio, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
Talking local politics, yeah, it's that time of year again. It is election season here in South Florida with lots of municipal elections, lots of local ballot questions in your neighborhood, in your community. What are you watching for? And also, how are you voting this election cycle? Vote by mail? Are you voting early? Are you waiting for Election Day, that first Tuesday after the first Monday in November? It's coming up. 800-743-WLRN is our phone number. Local elections, local politics. 800-743-WLRN here on the South Florida Roundup. You can also tweet us at WLRN. WLRN's digital editor, Lance Dixon, is with us, who watches all things in municipal city halls and county halls for us. So, Lance, some of these ballots are... Well, there's lots of ballots. Let me put it that way, right? What are some of the bigger, most notable races that that South Florida is watching?
Yeah, so I mean, beyond the congressional district stuff, which Antonio and you all just kind of talked about, there are elections happening in some of Miami-Dade County's biggest cities. So City of Miami and the City of Hialeah both have mayoral elections. They have commission seats and council races that are on the ballot. In City of Miami, there's a question going out to voters around the Virginia Key Marina. And then there's even stuff as far up in Palm Beach County. There's the town of Highland Beach is having an election about establishing a fire and rescue department up there. And then down in the Keys, there's a city council race in Marathon. So there's all kind of stuff all across our region. And I think it's really just a moment for folks to kind of take a look at, you know, 2020 obviously was a huge presidential election, a lot of stuff, and the midterms are coming up next year. But there's a lot happening probably in your neck of the woods if you're not paying attention.
Yeah, no, it's a great advice, right? I mean, all politics is local, and it doesn't get much more local than mayor, council member, and some of these ballot questions, which really are community issues, can be really around a certain neighborhood in the case of Miami Beach, for instance. I mean, it really is. It doesn't get much local than that, just a few block area, and how long can they serve alcohol? Talk about some of those ballot referenda.
Sure, yeah. So like you said, in Miami Beach, I mean, yeah, there's a mayoral race and there's some commission seats up, but I think most of what people living in that city have seen is stuff about this 2 a.m. rollback of alcohol sales in the South Beach area. And even the mayor had to address some things around that today. And so I think that that's a really big key. You know, you'll look at the top of the ballot and you'll see some of those names and some of those races. But if you keep going down, if you're looking at that sample ballot, I mean, City of Homestead has a bunch of stuff that folks need to keep an eye on, a lot of referenda down there. So definitely keep scrolling if you see that indicator on the side of your ballot there.
Yeah, be sure to check down ballot for those questions and read through those carefully sometimes. The wording sometimes can be a little tricky. But back to this point about local elections, Lance, I mean, we've got some big and growing cities in South Florida. I mean, Miami, certainly a large municipality. Hialeah, a very big city here in South Florida. I think one of the top six or seven cities in terms of population size in Florida. Homestead, a growing area, increasingly so.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. And Miami Beach, again, like we mentioned, another big place that garners a lot of attention.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, I think that that's a big thing underscoring a lot of what's going to be coming up on November 2nd is the idea that these are cities and areas that represent really, really large chunk of our population here outside of unincorporated Miami-Dade County, essentially.
Right. And so there have already been a few elections leading up to this election cycle. What are some of the issues that have popped up that have come across your radar as you've looked across these different municipalities? What are the common issues and what are some of the more individual ones?
Sure. So, I mean, I think a big one in a lot of these areas is bouncing back from the ongoing pandemic and how elected officials are going to address that. Development is always a big thing, especially in cities like Miami, Miami Beach. How do you do that in a way that's sustainable, that's equitable, and not sort of buy into different influences and things like that. And that's a big thing for candidates who I think are looking to see how they can differentiate themselves from these longstanding incumbents is really, you know, talking to people at a grassroots level and kind of seeing how they feel about the future of their cities, essentially, and what that will look like and how that balance will kind of strike between that those commercial interests and the folks, you know, just living on their streets.
Believe it or not, this is the second pandemic election.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. You know, last fall, the environment around the virus was a lot different because, of course, we didn't have vaccines and other treatments. How is the pandemic affecting the process of voting this time around?
So I think that folks will find that it's relatively similar to their previous experience, except there's a little bit more variability. There's not as much of a hard and fast rule around masks and things like that. But there are still drop boxes at early voting locations if you want to seek those out, and you can drop them off at different supervisor of elections offices on election day. Obviously, check with your county to make sure you have the right places and the locations for that. But I think for the most part, we'll see that those parts of the experience are very similar. And speaking of vote by mail, the deadline for that, if you're trying to do that, is tomorrow for most of the counties and municipalities.
And so what does somebody have to do by tomorrow if they do want to vote by mail?
Essentially, just go to your county supervisor of elections website and fill out a request form for that. I'm pretty sure all of them have a digital process for that now,
yeah.
So you can do that relatively swiftly and get that done.
There have been some reforms around voting that the Florida legislature passed and Governor Ron DeSantis signed. Will we see any of the impact of that if we go do early voting or vote by mail or vote on election day?
I believe that the biggest thing with that is you'll want to double check about your vote by mail status. So if you haven't gotten that or you have any questions about that, just go onto those websites and check your status, essentially.
Yeah.
And if you have missed any of those windows or anything like that, then you can check for early voting. You can essentially just make sure that you are as equipped with all the information that you need about your polling place, any of those sorts of things. And that's all accessible and can be found just by kind of typing in your address on those supervisor of election sites.
And we've got a gathering of those links on our website that you've put together as well.
Sure. Yeah. On WLRN.org, we have links to all of those, sample ballots, all the info you could want before the second.
Lots of municipal elections that are happening here. And one of the more curious questions for voters is whether or not to create yet another municipality. Tell us about this story around what could be Biscayne Gardens. What could be the 34th municipality?
35th.
Wow. See, I lost count already. 35th municipality in Dade County.
Sure. Yeah. So this has been an effort that's been in the works since at least 2003. When folks want to incorporate a municipality, there's a municipal advisory committee that comes together. And so Biscayne Gardens has been doing this for a while, and the boundaries for folks who are kind of curious about it is it kind of sits in between Miami Gardens, North Miami Beach. So think like Northwest 167th Street is the top of that area,
okay,
going down to about 128th and then extending out from there. So it covers an area that's about like 35,000 residents, about 18,000 or so registered voters in the area. So it's a pretty sizable place.
Yeah, right.
And a longstanding process that they've been trying to get going. And part of the delay with that, too, is after Cutler Bay was established in 2005, there was a moratorium until 2012 on any new municipalities being incorporated. So there was a kind of like cool off period to slow down the growth of these new cities and towns and whatnot. And so after that, a lot of these places that have been looking at this for a while decided, okay, let's get the processes restarted. And here we are now.
Fascinating. Well, let's go to one of the oldest municipalities in Dade County, Miami Beach. That's where Adam is listening. Adam, thanks for calling in. You're on the radio.
Hi, I just wanted to comment how much big money special interests are effective in our elections. That I'm a resident of Miami Beach. My grandparents were on Miami Beach. My parents, I was born here. My kids have grown up here. And all the residents that I know say, close at 2 a.m. We don't need the reputation that brings in people that are rowdy and have crime and so forth. And whether the crime is committed at 2 a.m. or earlier in the day, it's the reputation that's the problem. But I was at a press conference the mayor held today, and a whole group of people came out of Mango's who were organized there, given T-shirts, and marched down and surrounded the press conference. I mean, these are just special interest groups completely dominating our local elections, that we want safe streets for our children, and we want a neighborhood that's friendly for us. And I think that Mayor Gelber is doing a really good job, that it will reduce crime, and that when people say, for example, the study that was done saying that it would save money if we, there was a study done a couple of years ago saying it would save money because we wouldn't have to spend so much on policing. Mm-hmm. And I think that we want to do is have safe streets, and we don't want to have more police only to put them in the entertainment district from 2 to 5. That's
Adam,
not going to make our streets safer.
Thank you for adding your voice there on that the last call referenda question in Miami Beach. And Lance, Adam's point about you know, big contribution, special interests, and whatnot, the way I'd like to go with that is to get your thoughts on, after you know, the extreme politics of the last many years, we've seen or have we seen kind of that nationalization, that partisanship move into these local community elections, which on paper are nonpartisan?
Yeah, to an extent, it definitely has become more of an element. And even when they are nonpartisan, the sides of the issues kind of take on the de facto role of Democrat or Republican.
Right,
and so you're kind of seeing that this 2 a.m. ban, you know, supporters are very staunch about it and say that they want it to reduce crime. And the folks who are opposed to it say that there's no need for this. It won't actually solve the issue. And it becomes very, you know, aggressive on either side of this thing. I mean, and I think that ultimately, what it boils down to is what's going to happen at the ballot. When a similar proposal was proposed 4 years ago, it was roundly voted down by Miami Beach voters. So ultimately, we kind of have to see how it shakes out after all the noise.
Indeed. Lance Dixon, the digital editor here at WLRN. Much appreciated, Lance. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
And as Lance mentioned, we do have a link to those voter registration sites to check your voter registration status, your vote by mail status. You can find that at WLRN.org. And it's also, we just tweeted out that link at WLRN is our handle on Twitter. Still to come in our program, the security crisis is deepening in Haiti. How is the United States and the South Florida community responding? That's coming up next as the roundup continues. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for supporting public broadcasting. A Haitian gang leader has threatened to kill more than a dozen people. Police say he kidnapped last week. 17 people, 16 Americans and one Canadian, were taken in Haiti last weekend. Now, Haitian and U.S. officials say they're working to negotiate their releases. The kidnappers are said to be demanding $1 million in ransom for each captive. Gang violence has been on the rise in Haiti, a politically fragile country that went into a tailspin following the assassination of its president this past summer. The security situation has worsened as the country reels from an earthquake, the political instability, and a deepening economic crisis, in addition to the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. We want to hear from you here on the South Florida Roundup. Do you have ties to Haiti, family ties, business ties, cultural ties? What are you hearing from friends and family in the country about the rising violence, instability there? What concerns do you have in South Florida? What are your thoughts as you've been watching the kidnapping situation play out in Haiti? 800-743-WLRN. What about the American response? What about the South Floridian response? 800-743-9576. You can also share your thoughts on Twitter at WLRN. WLRN's America's editor, Tim Padgett, back with us here on the Roundup. Tim, what do we know about those who were kidnapped?
Well, they are 16 Americans and one Canadian, and including five children. One is young as 2 years old, or there may even be one younger, I think, which makes this so much more distressing. And they're all part of a Christian missionary relief group based in Ohio called Christian Aid Ministries. And unfortunately, this is just the latest religious group in Haiti that's been targeted by these gangs because, frankly, they are a easy and lucrative target.
Lucrative because the ransoms are paid?
Not because the ransoms are paid. For example, a Seventh-day Adventist pastor here in Miami was kidnapped last December along with his daughter. They were released a few days later. We don't know. The Seventh-day Adventists have not told us if a ransom was paid. The assumption among many in Haiti was that one was paid because they were released so soon. But the problem is that the Haitian gangs see these internationally based religious aid groups as having money.
So what do we know about this particular street gang that Haitian police have said is responsible for this kidnapping?
It's just one of several in Haiti right now, and they're getting stronger and stronger. This one, Mawoso 400, is based on the outskirts of Haiti, but we have so many others. Based on the outskirts of Port-au-Prince, right, the capital. But we have so many others in that area that exist. I mean, names like Delmas 6, Baznan Chabon, which means, burning charcoal, one that's called Crash Deef, spitting fire. I mean, they've all evolved into these very powerful, politically affiliated gangs, and that's the problem.
So how do they operate? How do these street gangs operate?
They have grown out of the chaos that grew out of the 2010 earthquake, and more specifically, they've grown out of the political and governmental chaos that was created by former President Michel Martelly, who was elected in 2011 as part of that, that chaos, that post-earthquake chaos. He started dismantling democratic institutions, and he started developing these gangs around Haiti as sort of as street enforcers. And that tradition was carried on then by Martelly's handpicked successor, Jovenel Moïse, who, as we know, was assassinated in July. But he even further consolidated this relationship between the government, specifically his party, the Tête Calée Party, which means Party of the Bald Heads, named after Martelly's bald head. He further consolidated that relationship between the ruling party in Haiti and the gangs. And that's really what's brought us to the situation we're at now.
So a significant political dimension to the street gang violence that parts of Haiti are gripped with.
Very much so. And what really worries me is that we may be seeing a situation developing in Haiti now that we saw for so many decades in Jamaica, where political parties had street gangs that were affiliated with them as sort of their enforcers. And I'd hate to see that happen in Haiti, but I believe it is.
Talk to us what you have experienced historically and even currently about sources of financing for these gangs and the weapons that are showing up on these videos, these social media videos that they're releasing.
That's the huge problem is the weapons that are being, and that's a great question about the funding. Let's take the big gang lord in Haiti right now. His name is Jimmy Cherizier. His nickname is Barbecue. He runs it's like the New York mob, Five Families, right? It's called the G9, Group of Nine. Gangs.
And these are nine different street gangs.
Nine different street gangs. It's an association. He runs it. He's a former cop who allegedly took part in some police massacres, the most notable being the one in the slum of La Saline back in 2018. He's a former cop now who has become the gang lord in Port-au-Prince in Haiti. And he allegedly, according to most the Crimex analysts we talk to, gets his funding from, again, that party of Martelly and Moïse, the Tête Calée party. And he is working sort of in tandem, allegedly, with a lot of the elites in that party because, again, there's that sort of street enforcer relationship that has developed between them and him.
Tony is listening in Miami. Tony, thanks for calling in. You're on the radio.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon. This is so well said from your guest. I think this is the type of conversation the U.S. State Department need to hear because it's just like they don't know. The U.S. State Department is well aware of all this gang going on in Haiti, the federation of gang created by Jovenel Moïse himself to kill as many people as he can. And they know Street Mickey himself is a gang member. He was forced upon the throat of the Haitian people to become president by Hillary. And all this terrible thing that's been happening in Haiti for the last 10 years, the U.S. Department is right there and never say any word. And they only support the gang in Haiti. This is so cruel. This is so unheard for. And we are here in Haiti, and the community are supporting, putting this thing in our heart every day, not able to talk to our family in Haiti. This is so crazy. And then we ask for the world to help us get rid of this gang. This gang, they receive fully support of the U.S. Department ever since. This thing needs to be stopped and stopped right now.
Yeah, boy, he brings up two great points about this whole tragedy. The first being how this is affecting Haitians themselves, not just the kidnapped victims, and God knows there are plenty of those. I mean, last year it was estimated at this time of the year that there were four major kidnappings a day in Haiti. It's gotten worse since then. But his point about how this is affecting Haitians in terms of we've got thousands of Haitians who are displaced from their homes right now in Haiti because of the warring going on the streets between these rival gangs. I mean, they're like refugees, war refugees in their own country. The second great point he makes is the United States is, shall we say, culpability for this. Not so much its direct culpability, but it's the blame that goes with our negligence. The United States' negligence since the earthquake. He mentioned Hillary Clinton. Right. Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State in the early part of the last decade, was widely criticized by Haitians for allowing Michel Martelly to come to power, and subsequent governments like the Trump administration were criticized for just turning their back on what Jovenel Moise was doing.
It's a real just horrific situation, and certainly South Florida and the diaspora and the broader community here watching closely, looking for opportunities to lend assistance in so many different ways. Tim Padgett, America's editor here at WLR, and thanks for sharing the reporting with us.
Thanks, Tom.
That is our program here on the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Andrea Perdomo. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. News director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director. The director of radio operations is Peter J. Meritz. Richard Ives is the technical supervisor this week. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting public radio. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist.
WLRN Public Media.